the minority lead, Representative Holberg, and gave her a heads up, but we're going to recess for a few minutes. I don't have a time certain. It'll be recessing to a call of the chair. Hopefully it won't take us too long, and we will communicate with you by email as soon as we're going to reconvene.
If I might, Mr. Chair, in reviewing the packet, there is a new fiscal note, but the one in the packet is still the 6E version, so
yeah,
members might want a 7 E version.
What the way the bill sits in committee is the first version, and when I heard that there was the potential of an amendment with some fiscal impact, I asked for a second fiscal note, and that would only apply if that amendment went on, and then people would see, or when that amendment is before us, you can see what the fiscal note says about the amendment. So
if I might, so the 7E fiscal note doesn't reflect the version of the bill that's before the 7E bill that's in committee?
I don't remember which number is on which one, Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, your statement was correct. The 7E version does not, of the fiscal note, would reflect the 7E version of the bill plus the A199 amendment. So the numbers aren't quite lined up here. The A199 amendment makes some changes, and that's what's reflected in the 7E version of the fiscal note. The 6E version was done prior to the tax committee and actually was for the 6th and engrossment of it, and we got a 7E rather than an 80 or an A version of the fiscal note. But the 7E version of the fiscal note would reflect the bill plus the A199 amendment.
So that if that amendment goes on, then that's what that second fiscal note would reflect. If the amendment does not go on, then it would be the first fiscal note the way it came into committee. Representative Abler.
Thank you. Just can you give us a ballpark what you're thinking? Like, should we go eat supper and come back? Like,
no, I wouldn't do that. I don't.
Like half an hour?
I'm going to try to make it as briefly as possible. So I'd hold on supper. We don't have a lot of amendments, so hopefully your lunch will take you through for a little bit. I wouldn't wander too far for anyone. So with that, we'll communicate by email. We're in recess to the call of the chair. And I'd like to reconvene the Ways and Means Committee. I want to thank everybody for the delay, but there were a couple of issues that we needed to talk about relative to some of the amendments. So first item, we do have a quorum. We do have the minutes from the February 25th meeting. Representative Huntley moves.
I wasn't there.
So I guess you should have been present to move the minutes. How about Representative Hornstein? He's sitting next to you. Were you there?
Yes, let me just take a minute.
Otherwise, I know Representative Holberg was
there. I'll move approval of the minutes.
Okay, the motion is before us to approve the minutes of February 25th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Atkins, we did meet yesterday and you did give us an overview of the bill. So I think what we'll do this evening then is go right to the amendments. And there are three of them, and I think they're all three yours. So is there a particular order that you'd like to take the amendments?
Mr. Chairman, the A...
Oh. And we also, we also need to have you move the bill.
I would be happy to. I would renew my motion that House File 5 be recommended pass and referred to the House for General Register, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, motion is before us. Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A199 amendment, which is a technical amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us. If you'd like to comment on the... You say it is technical.
Mr. Chairman, it is. We've, during the course of 8 engrossments of this bill, we've lost a little bit of language here and there and are fixing some items that have been brought to our attention primarily by staff. And if it pleases the chair, I'd like to call upon the, because of the technical nature, to call upon the exchange staff to walk through briefly what the technical changes are.
Okay, that would
Thank
be fine.
You, Mr. Chairman.
Which staff person?
Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to start with, we've got a couple fiscal items that Ms. Julich, who is the CFO for the exchange, she'll speak to those, and then a couple with respect to rules of privacy that Mr. Will have a privacy expert speak to those, or rules person. Ms. Julich?
Mr. Chair, members, I can speak to three of the lines on the amendment. On line 1.3, it inserts some clarification language on how the inflationary cap will be measured in calendar 16. Currently, the language in the bill caps it at the rate of inflation. However, it doesn't take into account the 30% increase in enrollment between years. And so this language would just allow that inflationary calculation would also adjust for enrollment changes from year to year. And that is what is, and the changes of that are reflected in the new fiscal note. And that's the change, that's the portion of the amendment that is triggering the new fiscal note. The other two fiscal changes are purely technical. They aren't fiscal changes, but they're on the finance side and purely technical. On line 1.14, deleting the word fund and inserting an account in the special revenue fund is just defining where the funding revenue would be deposited. So it's clarifying which of the state funds this money is deposited into. And on line 1.15, deleting everything after the word and. Currently in the bill, this is changing from a one-year appropriation to a statutory appropriation.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I do have
there's
a couple final items that Mr. Turpin, who's counsel for the exchange, can speak to the changes relative to the rule and privacy modifications. And I think he can do that in about a minute. So there's just a couple lines left on the amendment.
Okay. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mike Turpin, general counsel for the exchange. Mr. Chair, representatives, beginning at line 1.6, there's the deletion of the phrase modified access or disseminated by authorized individuals, replacing that with entered updated access or shared or disseminated outside of the marketplace. This language is to harmonize earlier reference in on line 16.4 to use the same language in both places, that enter access and update. The phrases of shared or disseminated are common in the data practices field to identify between sharing between state agencies versus disseminating, which would be disclosing outside of a government entity. On line 1.10 through 1.13, this provision clarifies that the access to data and the audit trail language really applies only to those individuals who are able to view the data of others. So therefore, individuals who are accessing this to participate on their own behalf, they do not need to receive explicit authorization from the board to access their own data. And furthermore, there would not be a data audit trail created of an individual's access to their own data.
Okay. That's it on the amendment.
And yes, Mr. Chair, and with that, we stand for
okay, any discussion? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have a number of questions, but let's start with the last first, I guess. Are you saying you're not going to keep an audit trail of the individual participants' interactions with the exchange?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, we would be maintaining that audit trail, but we wanted to make clear that that would not be the type of audit trail that would become public. So in other words, an individual who is accessing their own data, that audit trail would not be, be made public as this provision provides for the audit trail of an individual who is an employee or navigator or broker. So the provision on lines 16.8 through 16.10 provides for the creation of a data audit trail, and that is really the intent was really to be able to monitor the use of employees, agents, navigators, brokers, others who would have some authority to access the data of others. The intent of that was not necessarily to track how individual Minnesotans would utilize this self-service tool. But to your point, certainly there would be records kept of, you know, the information input into the application, and data of access. Those things would certainly be retained, as would be necessary for an appeal or other functions of the exchange.
And if I might, would the individual data subject have access to the audit trail information about them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, certainly they would.
All right, and then if I might go back to the inflation issue, I'm not sure I understand exactly why you would need an inflation factor, given that the tax is a percent of the value of the policy or the plan. Last I heard, healthcare is going up nearly every year, a substantial amount. So if it's a portion of the cost of the plan, why do you need an inflating factor of enrollment and beyond that lifting? I think what it does is it lifts that cap. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way it was written before, the cap was on the calendar year 16 cap was on the calendar year 15 amount collected. And so in 16, you couldn't collect more than 1.164% of what you collected in 15. And so it wouldn't take into account any of your enrollment changes. It wouldn't take into account any of the premium changes. It wouldn't take any of that into account. And so by the way it was written, it created this really odd incentive of having your calendar year 15 rate too high in order to make your 15 rate doable. But if you can take into account enrollment changes within that inflationary calculation, then you don't have this incentive to bring 15 up higher than's necessary, and then it's the inflation within the growth of the participation growth. So you'd recognize that your participation changed 30% or 20% or whatever it changed by, and then do the inflation from there.
And Mr. Chair, from what I understand, so it's not an inflation factor to the rate of the tax, but rather to the amount of the carryover funds. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's the amount total collected is what the inflation was applied to, not to the rate, but to the total.
Okay, and then if you look at the old 6E fiscal note, we had the information where it said when the plan was going to go broke, and then that information disappeared in the 7E fiscal note. Is when does the plan go broke? Because I'm led to believe that the changes in the 7E reflect an amendment that hasn't actually been in the 77th engrossment, which is kind of odd. But it doesn't look like the numbers changed, only the language disappeared.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and Representative, the numbers do change on the revenue side. So the expenditures don't change, but the revenues do. And so you are correct in that negative structural balance goes away or gets reduced significantly between the 6E version and the 7E version. The expenditures don't, or the estimated costs don't change, but the estimated revenues do change. And so that language regarding that structural imbalance feeding down the budget reserve is impacted by the amendment. And so the 7E version reflects different withhold rates, taking into account that 15 can now be a lower amount and 16 can now be an amount that's necessary for 16 versus an amount that's too low and is eating into that reserve at a significant rate.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I need some time to digest it, but
Any further discussion on the amendment? Well, seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Atkins, you have a couple more amendments. Which one do you want to take next?
Next up, Mr. Chair, I would move the A-194 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us, if you want to comment on the amendment.
I would, Mr. Chairman, on this adds a little bit of language to reflect what's been spoken about, but was never fully reflected in the bill. It goes on page 2, line 23, where we have language that talks about our goals to promote innovation, competition, quality, value, and a variety of other good things. But we've always talked about how we're trying to promote informed consumer choice through those points. And somebody made the point to me at in between the last committee and this one that the whole point of having all these good things with value and so forth was to make sure we had an informed consumer. I thought that made sense. And I would offer that, that we want to have informed consumers making these choices. So I would, with that background, move the A-194 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Then any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Atkins, you have one more amendment. It's the A-202, so I assume that that's the one you're interested in moving.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A-202 amendment.
Okay, and if you want to explain the amendment.
I would be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Throughout the course of the hearings on this bill, we have heard concern about whether plans would have, carriers would have any degree of certainty about having certain products available in the market. And the concern that arose, at least the concern that struck home with me, was that without any level of degree of certainty that a particular carrier would be able to sell products in this new marketplace, they may not make the very significant investment in the IT infrastructure to allow them to connect up in the first place. Without that assurance, and this is, in fairness, I've seen other states across the country look at what will it, what's necessary in order to get plans to participate at the outset of this marketplace. Some have gone just with a full-blown clearinghouse model, letting everybody in no matter what their product is. They can sell anything they want to. The point being to get them in and then be able to sort of narrow the choices later on. That was not something that has proven to be comfortable to folks, but it has. There's been a concern expressed in past committees about balancing that level of certainty so that the carriers would know they could get certain products in against the desire to get certain high-quality products in. And the folks who want high quality have made the argument for an active selector model where you could apply, but there was no assurance that you would get in. And what I said yesterday, Mr. Chairman, I described that active selector version as if there's only a couple hundred spots in a college class available and you get 7,000 applicants, you know that you're going to get some really high-quality products. What I'm afraid of, and the reason for the amendment, is that we won't get those applicants in the first place if there's not at least some reasonable degree of certainty that they'll get in, because the application fee is so incredibly high, namely the cost of the IT infrastructure. That enormous investment that a carrier needs to make without having any guarantee that they're going to get a product in could be a real chilling factor in whether or not they move forward with it. So the amendment provides for what I guess I'd call some sort of hybrid in between the two. There would be a guarantee that each carrier at each level, the catastrophic, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, would have an opportunity to offer two products at each level. To the extent that they wanted additional products, they'd go through the active selector model that's in the bill as under its current draft. The restrictions on what would be allowed in, and keep in mind, by the way, I think this goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, is that in 2014, we don't have active selector. We don't have, based on what was submitted to Washington, D.C. back in October, and that that was blessed and approved, we don't have active selector. We have a situation where they've just got to comply with an HMO standard for network adequacy and certain other requirements, but the HMO standard, by definition, is a higher standard than what most people have now. And we can get into that if folks would desire to do so. But any plan sold in the marketplace in 2014 has been a pretty darn good plan, because that's what got approved by DC, and we can't, if we don't comply with that, and that level of HMO standard, which means people got the good amount of choice for which doctor or which hospital to go to, then if we don't comply with that at the outset, then we're not complying with what's been approved, and we end up with a federal exchange. So 2014, we are going to have that level of a plan in the that level of product in the exchange. For 2015, then we would go to this model where folks would be able to get in two products at each meta level, and the first product would have to be at least their most popular product at each level. That accomplishes a couple things. Number one, it's got to be a good plan, because in order to get in 2014, it had to meet that HMO level standard, so that you're guaranteed it's a good plan. But it also, and Ms. Malmlov has harped on me since the beginning of this, that we need to protect ourselves against the possibility of adverse selection. And that is that we would pour all of the bad risk into the exchange and all the good risk stays outside. And as a result of that, you end up with this devolving kind of death spiral that the exchange would end up in if we ended up. And I know people like Representative Davids, who spent 30 years, I think, in this business, understands the fear of adverse selection. So by getting the most popular plans being offered in the exchange, we get that number of bodies that will mitigate against the probability of adverse selection. In addition to that, the plans would be able to get one more plan at each meta level. And all that, too, would be dictated by a Part B of the amendment. Section B of the amendment talks about the network adequacy standards. It would have to be consistent with those network adequacy standards that are set forth as a result of those popular plans. So, again, it's going to be a very high level of network adequacy. Lots of choice, lots of doctors, lots of hospitals relative to the at least what people are typically able to buy today. So we're going to ensure ourselves of having two reasonably strong plans in the marketplace to begin with. The plans carriers get the assurance that they'll be able to get some plans in, which hopefully will then encourage not just the big three that do pretty well in Minnesota, but the next folks too. Numbers 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 will also be encouraged to invest in the infrastructure necessary to connect their IT product or their IT systems with the IT system for the marketplace. And we'll have a good, strong, vibrant, robust, competitive market in the first couple of years to get this thing going. I think after that, it's going to sustain itself. Everybody will want to be in once they've made the initial investment. But the very first step is critical, and that is when people walk in the door, we want them to know and be assured that they'll be able to find a popular product that they has a high level of network adequacy, a lot of choices for who they can see as far as their doctors or what hospital they can go to, and giving the assurance to the carriers that they'll know they'll be able to get in. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to stand for any questions or whatever the desire of the chair is as far as getting further explanation of the amendment.
Okay, are there any questions?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I forgot one thing, and that is that a request was made this morning that we put in language also that if plans are not, even though they're guaranteed to get in, that they can be knocked out if they aren't good, if they don't, and this is by federal law, but I put it in the amendment as well, and that is they can be deselected. They can be kicked out if they're not living up to, if they make representations about what their network is going to be. If they make this is no different than what the Department of Commerce has a right to do this now, but we wanted to make sure to send this message that if you're not living up to your representations, that doesn't mean you just automatically get to keep selling in this exchange. Even though we've given you some level of certainty that you can get in, you can get bounced out if you don't comply with federal law and with what the Department of Commerce says. So that is the final provision in the amendment as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the amendment is before us. I do have a question, Representative Atkins. Being that this amendment is new as far as the language, was this discussed in the, what was it, 7 or 8 previous committees?
Mr. Chairman, the topic of active selector and whether it should and how it should function, I believe has been discussed in every committee.
So it's not something that's new, even though the language is new. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely correct. This has been a topic that's come up frequently, and I've tried to incorporate, quite honestly, some of the suggestions that we've gotten from those prior committees into this amendment.
Sir, I'm going to ask if there's anybody in the audience then that hasn't had a chance to engage in that discussion earlier present that would like to comment. That's the way we operated yesterday. We had 60-some people, remember, that testified, and some of them multiple times through the process. But if there's somebody present that hasn't had a chance to weigh in that would like to, this would be the opportunity on the amendment. I'm talking now about the amendment. Okay, seeing none, then Representative Dittner.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned in your amendment, A202, on page 3.4, if they don't live up to their expectations, you said they can be kicked out. What happens to all the people that they are currently insured? Do they go out with them, or what happens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dittner, it's no different than what would currently happen now. If the Department of Commerce were to come in and say you haven't lived up to your end, they would have two options. One would be probably more than that, but the two most basic options. One would be that the department would force them to live up to their to what they've promised. The second, and probably more dramatic, would be I would assume that they would take those folks, put them in a different plan, and make the plan live up to it, and potentially charge damages against those plans that fail to comply. So it's a pretty dire, and this is not, by the way, this is a new law. This is something that the health carriers live under right now, as far as what the Department of Commerce. If you don't live up to your word, they can come and take you out to the woodshed.
Representative Dettner, is that? Okay, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Chair Atkins. This, I think, is a step. I can't believe I'm saying this. I think this is a step in the right direction.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw the amendment immediately.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
that was a joke, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Atkins, as I read through this, it doesn't get us where I'd like to be. It doesn't get us as far as I'd like to go, but I think it's some good movement here, so I want to vote for this, and I don't want to kill it for you, but I think it doesn't go anywhere as far as I'd like to, but I think we're making some progress here, a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins, first, thanks for all the hard work you've done on this bill, all these committees. Just a couple of concerns, if you could comment on. You're significantly increasing the number of products. Do you have any concerns that consumers might feel overwhelmed or just too many choices here? They can't just take this out in bite-sized chunks you can err on the side. I mean, choice is great. We can err on the side of, too many. So any thoughts about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, yes, I do have thoughts on that. And I don't know exactly what the precise balance is. Right now, under the current version of the bill, the guaranteed number of entrants is zero. So this is definitely more than zero. On the other extreme, we have over 700 different health insurance products now available in the Minnesota marketplace. And it is truly overwhelming. I mean, as a health insurance consumer, my little small business, you don't even know where to start. There's 11 carriers operating in Minnesota. We're already pretty well assured that three are not going to participate. I'm guessing that three probably for sure will participate. So if we, pick a number on the high end of the number of, if let's say that seven of the carriers operating in Minnesota choose to participate under this amendment, at four different levels, catastrophic, bronze, silver, and gold, they each get to offer two plans. That, if my math is correct, is 56 plans in the individual market. And then in the small group market, they can offer 56 plans. For me, that is a number that's a little more manageable for me, and I think that would be likely anticipated. And then to the extent that there would be more plans, keep in mind we keep the active selector. If they want to apply to the board to get more plans in, they could. So there's a possibility it could end up being a handful more than 56 in the individual and 56 in the small group.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. Thank you for that, Representative Atkins. Any also concerns about impacts on quality then? Because, you know, with these additional entrances into the market, can you reassure us on the quality of the product being sold?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Orenstein, as a result of what was certified by the federal government, when we submitted our blueprint back in October and it was approved by the feds, in 2014, and we're not allowed to have active selector, but we have to meet the certain level of standard that was approved by the feds. And the one that stands out most to me, and all of these plans I think will be better than what most people buy here in Minnesota, because what they certified was an HMO level standard. And for network adequacy, for example, that means that and most people in Minnesota are not part of an HMO. HMO adequacy is a much higher level of provider access and choices than the average Minnesota consumer has today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, on when you talk about the most popular, could you kind of define what the most popular plan would be?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Woodard. Better than that, I would point to line 1.24 so that it's not my definition, but what's in the amendment, and that is the most popular health benefit plan is determined by the highest enrollment inside and outside the Minnesota insurance marketplace by the number of lives at the end of the open enrollment period in the preceding year. And then it excludes health benefits plans that have already been closed. So we'll literally look at both inside and outside the market, the number of lives that are insured under each of their various individual plans offered in the individual market, and then each of their plans offered in the small group market, and take what the most popular plan is inside and outside, combining those two, and that will define what's the most popular.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is along the lines of Representative Hornstein was kind of stealing my thunder a little bit on some of the questions on choice and how you keep the quality there. I noticed in some of the letters that we have in our packets here that, you know, folks are talking about making sure that the exchange acts as an active purchaser, not just on a shelf, that insurance company can stack dozens of plans and those kinds of things. And I know AARP testified to that as well. And I think what you're saying is that this is sort of an in-between those two thought processes that we've talked about in previous committees. But I was also curious about whether or not the committee has received any other letters other than the ones we have here that may be in opposition to or have asked to be part of this package. Do you know, Mr. Chair?
Representative, what are the only ones that I'm aware of that we received are in the packet? There may be people that received individual emails, but the ones in the packet are the ones where they basically said that they were submitting written testimony.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, I wander uppity into this area. As I shared with you, this is nowhere near my my area of expertise. But I do know, excuse me, after having been here for a number of years, that it's not unusual at all for a state, in particular the state of Minnesota, to set standards in a number of different policy areas that are higher, sometimes substantially higher, than what the federal government sets for us. And so I'm not sure I understand how all the pieces work here, but my question is, does this amendment restrict our prospective ability as a state to be able to set standards in terms of those participating in the exchange and offering services? To set standards at any point that are higher than the federal government standards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mariani, for the question. The first thing I would do is point you to Section A of the bill,
there's still a market rules piece of legislation that is moving through and that will apply both in and outside, and that can, as a legislature, not just Joe Atkins, but as a legislature, we still reserve the right and have specifically, expressly in this amendment, reserve the right to have an impact there. Beyond that, to the extent that the feds have dictated certain guidelines, for example, we're not addressing the essential health benefit group. That is something we anticipate getting further guidance on. I use that one as an example, though, Representative Mariana, because that is one where I suspect what the feds will do is say, okay, you have to at least do this, but you can go beyond that. In fact, they've already kind of alluded to that we can require additional things that will just be on our dime. So I anticipate that's the sort of guidance that we will continue to get from the feds, is that we can do more, but not less. But it is a little bit of an open question yet, because I don't think we've got full guidance yet from the feds in terms of what we can and can't do. But if the EHB is any indication, I think they're going to set a minimum bar and then allow us to go beyond it. One final, and I apologize for going on too long, but we preserve the adverse, or the, not the adverse, we preserve the active selector to the extent that folks want to get additional plans in. And that is something that sets a very high bar, and it's obviously made the carriers and others quite nervous. But we preserve that to the extent that they want to get in any plans beyond the two at each metal level. They'd still have to go through the active selector method in order to get anything in.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Atkins, thank you. That certainly helps. So I get the answer to the question in terms of some of the mechanics, as you just explained, and also as maybe "quote unquote" allowed by, you know, federal direction. So kind of at a more earthy, if you will, possible result. Does this amendment, by allowing such a broad, my word, scope of participation, do you anticipate that level of participation could impede future efforts to raise standards in terms of participation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, I think it only helps. And the reason I say that is because if we open up a marketplace, let's say it was a grocery store, and we don't get the providers, the producers, to participate in our grocery store to begin with, then we're not going to get very good products at the end. If nobody's coming and shopping in our market because there just aren't really any products in there to begin with, that's what my biggest fear is. And as a result, then you don't have the desire from producers to want to be in the marketplace. And that's why I've constructed the amendment that offers limited but guaranteed access of certain high-quality plans, because they have to, by definition, be high-quality. Once we get their most popular plans, it's like Target or a grocery store. If you've got good products in there that people want to use or want to buy, plus you have the tax credit, I think this is going to be a very popular way to buy people's health insurance, and that only will contribute in the long run as we move and continue with the active selector model to get additional plans in. I think it only lifts the bar if we've got a marketplace where consumers want to go and their very first experience is a positive one.
Mr. Chair, I won't belabor it, and just more a quick statement than a question. Representative Atkins, I certainly hope you're correct about that, and I understand the logic of it, and I think that it has merit when you have a responsible marketplace, and when you have a responsible marketplace that exists within a strong regulatory presence that looks out for the best interests of those who have, in my opinion, for those who have the minimal ability to fully participate in that marketplace like everyone else. And so all that by way of saying that, you know, my read of past behavior in this marketplace is at best mixed in terms of those who are offering services compared to the quality. And so that's going to be a constant filter, if you will, that I'm going to keep applying to this bill and frankly, any policy that we support that attempts to manipulate, if you will, or encourage the marketplace to provide essential services to people. But I thank you for you know, wrestling with this issue, and I suspect that we share a common concern in terms of wanting to deliver the highest quality services to people, and to be able to do that in a way that we can constantly adjust that, you know, as realities dictate out in the marketplace and out on the ground. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Good noise, real quick. Well, thanks. This is I've been working on this since July with some intensity. I think I've talked to every group in the state who has an opinion about this. And many more times, Erickson Atkins has talked to all of them just as much as me. And I respect his effort in this. I would have read it a little differently, but I think he's on the track, and I can't imagine the discussions you've had, and especially lately. You know, the word popular health plan, I was thinking of having amendment way cool, but you redefined it, so it's, that wouldn't have worked quite as well. But at some point, I think that we have to let plans be the plans, and they could actually select. And I don't think they're going to be bringing bad plans in. And just for Representative Mariani, for your, just to make it more clear, the oversight here, Commerce has current standards, and there's some federal standards. And just to help you understand, the Gottwald bill from 2011 didn't have the additional standards the board is going to be imposing upon this group. It could be higher loss ratio standards, some other standards about whatever they decide makes sense. And so that's actually a high bar. And so if you achieve that, you've achieved higher credentialing than any plan in Minnesota has probably had to do yet. And under the current bill, they could decertify if they don't comply with that. That's quite a big hammer. So if you know my past, you know I've not been always happy with the plans in my profession. We've squabbled with them for my 34 years. But I do realize that this thing actually has to work. When they push the button on October 1st, there has to be enough brains and competent programming and business acumen going into this thing to make it work. And that's a very hard thing to guarantee. I was talking to some of the technology people this week, and there's a lot of impediments this thing going, so it's not a guarantee we'll pass the bill on time. But I there's three other matters I just want to remind people about that complicate this. One is the market rules bill that was mentioned, and it's those could, that means you leave the exchange different alone, the word outside the exchange and alone from what is outside the exchange. So you that's important. The fee remains, the 3.5% remains a challenge. And you have to have competent, inclusive board members who actually understand what they're doing. But back to the amendment, there's going to be two national plans. We haven't gone too far in the weeds here, but some of the members haven't had the privilege of hearing this bill before, so I'll just be very brief. Two national plans get to come in eventually, one profit, one for-profit, one non-profit, and they get to be included. And so that's meaningful to the people that are concerned about whether this group can choose or not. I think high compliance is a really, really good bar. But remember, these groups that we're talking about not letting in are Minnesota companies with Minnesota employees that have a long track record of serving Minnesotans through all the standards and criteria we put them through over my 14 years and beyond. So these are quality companies, and we have our arguments with them, and I have bills to pound on them sometimes, but there are companies, you know, and there are staff. I know there's one, I won't burden you with a name, but it's a smaller company of the 11, and it's going to cost them $5 million to comply with all the stuff they estimate. And if they can't be sure that they're going to get in, they're not going to spend the $5 million. And what we risk if we don't have some guarantee to be in is that you may get one of the big ones becoming the dominant, even more dominant. And I think the best competition is when you have many Minnesota caring plans and a couple national ones actually seeking to serve our people here. So I commend you for your efforts. I'll keep working with you. I'm going to vote for this today. Thank you for a job. This has been harder than you thought, I bet, Representative Atkins. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair. So, Representative Atkins, so if your plan is allowed in this year and it's based on your previously most popular plan, what happens the next year? Is it the plan you had in this year or your next year's most popular plan? So is it a moving target or does it stay the same? And if it stays the same, then what happens if we change mandates or we change the law about what has to be included or not included in terms of insurance coverage? What happens to the plan if it's the one we let in today and then we change the rules?
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, an excellent question and multi-pronged, so I'll try to address. First off, in year one, we don't have control. In year, because of what's already been approved by the federal government, they're in. There is no active selector. There's nothing further that we can do. Now, in year two, we'll look at what was the most popular plans at each of the meta levels. In year one, and those will be guaranteed admission into year two. Then for year three, under the amendment, we do the same thing. We'd look at it during the open or the enrollment period, see what, and this is both true inside and outside the marketplace, see what the most popular plan is when you combine a number of lives insured inside and outside, and that would be the plan that they would be guaranteed admission of. Now, that's not to say that they couldn't apply for additional plans. But they'd have to go through the active selector method in order to get those in. Did I answer all of the, or did I miss anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this year plan number one is the most popular, and next year that's a different plan, does then the plan that people are qualified for be more popular plan? I'm just trying to...
I think I'm tracking where you're going. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, let's say in the following year, so in the first year that we're dealing with popular plans, this is the one that they're allowed to sell through the exchange, and people buy it. At the end of that year, if let's perhaps that one is no longer the most popular plan, doesn't mean the plan goes away. The people can still choose to re-up with that plan through the Blues or through Medicare, whoever they might have secured that plan from. But there would be we do the measure to see what the most popular plan is. And that would be the one that they'd be guaranteed admission of in the market, in addition to the one other. And that, you know, consumers then would go online, they'd see that most popular plan, but that doesn't foreclose the possibility that they could still enroll in some other alternative plan. Well,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then what's happening is if plan number one is the most popular plan this year, and plan number two is the most popular plan next year, and plan number three is the most popular plan the next year, you could end up with the same companies then with three plans in the pool because each one had each year there was a different most popular plan. Is that
actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, actually under the amendment, the answer to that would be no. If your plan was no longer the most popular, let's talk about plan number one, which you represented was not the most popular in year number two.
Right.
By definition, that would no longer be a guaranteed plan that they could offer through the exchange. They could apply to the board, and I don't know what the board would do, but my guess would be that if they thought it was an appropriate plan, they'd probably let that one continue to be sold in the marketplace.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then what happens if we change the rules then about what mandated coverages are? For example, if we mandate that chiropractic is covered in all these plans or mental health coverage.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, that is something that's always in the realm of possibilities that the legislature may do. And that whether that's a realistic example or not, the fact is that we can't bind the hands of future legislature. There's certainly a possibility that future legislatures could make changes to this exchange.
Okay, Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to the language on page 2, line 35, I'm not sure what certification guidance is, and guidance to me doesn't mean standards, it means close enough. So would you explain to me what you're trying to get at there?
Mr. Chair, if it's all right, Representative Holberg, that in this world, that's kind of a term of art. And rather than potentially, I think I know what it is, but if it's all right, I'd like to have Ms. Momlov give me a hand, because when we met with folks, we originally had a different word, and now we have guidance, and I think she could probably better explain it than I could. If that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Okay, if you got to identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is April Todd Mullen. I'm the exchange director. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, what certification guidance means is referencing what we submitted in our blueprint in November, and that is based on some guidance that we put out to the plans in October that essentially established what the certification guidelines would be for 2014. And so it's a term of art to reference that specific guidance that we put out in October.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Todd Melmbaum, I'm sorry, is there a name on that document, or is it, at least on the next page you actually reference, you know, a public law with a number.
Ms. Melmbaum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it is referenced as certification guidance on that document.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, within that document, do they have to hit 50% of the guidelines, 80%, 100%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, they have to meet 100% of that for us to be compliant with federal law.
All right, thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the amendment A202, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. That concludes the amendments. Is there anyone now in the audience who has not testified on the bill in the past? We wanted to make sure that anybody that has not had an opportunity has that opportunity. Okay, very good. Would you care to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, over.
I have some questions on the bill and the money as amended. And
no, that's fine.
All right, thank you. I'm still trying to figure out how this saves people money, and from what I've been able to figure out, the amendment that was adopted earlier tonight actually allows for even more revenue to be collected, even more tax, if you will, on these plans. By adding in that inflation factor. So can you explain to me how, when we're spending all these millions of dollars, we just heard of a health care plan that it's going to cost $5 million to do their system update to integrate with this one. It sounds like we're easily in about the $200 million range by the time we get the state system up. 11 plans, adding technology upgrades to their systems. That's all going to have to be paid for by consumers. And I'm just curious as to where we get the savings here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, let's start with the two options that we have. One is a federal exchange and one is a state exchange. The federal exchange will have a 3.5% premium withhold built in because they've already said that that's what they're going to do. And that is how they'll fund their whatever it costs. I'm guessing it'll cost a whole heck of a lot more than $56 million, which is what we anticipate here in Minnesota. So that's under the federal approach. Under the state approach, we anticipate, based on our modeling, that it will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5% of a premium withhold. And that will be the amount that will go towards paying the $56 million annual operating cost. The savings are designed to come from, number one, the enhanced competition among the carriers and the products that they offer, which is something that, you know, some would argue that we have that in today's market. Others would argue quite strenuously that we don't have much competition in today's market. And the point of competition is to drive up quality and drive down cost as a result of that competition. In addition to that, there will be many families in Minnesota that will be able to avail themselves of the federal tax credits that are only allowed to be secured if people buy through the exchange. And for some, that will yield, combined with the enhanced competition, average savings of $490 per family. For some, it'll be up to $1,700 or $1,800 per family. For me and my family, it wouldn't yield anything at all because we wouldn't qualify for the tax credits. But just having the benefit of additional competition will yield some savings, or it's anticipated to yield savings as a result of the competition, and then also for small businesses where the average savings are expected to be about 7.5%.
Mr. Chair, I really don't care about the federal exchange versus the state exchange. I'm way back on this great experiment is going to save money for the average consumer purchasing health care. And one of the documents that I've been given is out of the 2012 Gruber-Gorman analysis, which I understand within maybe the next 72 hours we're going to get the update, so these numbers I understand might change, but it talked about what the impacts would be on individual plans, and it talks about the essential health benefits set an 8 to 11% increase, merging into the individual market a 10 to 15% increase, the new risk in the market, which the guaranteed issue, which is from what I understand, our MCHA going away and hopping into a new federal standard, 15 to 20% increased, and then what you talked about, the managed competition effect being a 7.5% decrease, but the combined total of all of this together, their best estimate is about a 29% increase in costs, and I feel sorry for your family because it doesn't sound like you're going to get any tax credit on this. And it sounds like the way they're going to impose this tax is going to be across all plans. So you're, even though you probably won't, maybe you will or won't participate in buying through the market, if you're outside of it, you're going to still pay that tax. So, it sounds like everything's going to be more expensive compared to where we are today.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Holbrook, I appreciate that question because it allows me to sort of delineate what we're talking about. What we're talking about with the exchange is different than what we're talking about with the Affordable Care Act. And Representative Grunhagen and I have gone back and forth about 6 times in different committees because he keeps wanting to talk about the overall impact of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Law will obviously, I have no doubt that that will increase costs. When you can't turn folks away and you've got to take all risks and you've got to take everybody that comes. And that's why Dr. Gruber has said, in fact, yeah, we're going to see higher costs across, I think, all plans. Just about everybody around the country is going to see higher costs as a result of the Affordable Care Law. So I'm not arguing with that at all. But to the extent that we've got a good, vibrant marketplace where folks have to compete for my business, that piece of it brings it down, and that's the second part of what you referenced there. So whether you like the Affordable Care Law or not, there's no question that having a good, vibrant marketplace where folks have to compete for your business, that helps the situation a little bit, but it's not. I fully expect that the ultimate end net is going to be that people pay more for their health insurance. No question.
Well, and if these, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, if these are even in the ballpark, I mean, we're looking at, if you take out the managed competition effect, we're looking at more than a 35% increase in health care costs. And, I mean, I think so much of the talking point around this is that it's going to save money, it's going to save money. And I just don't see how the numbers work here to save money.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burton, I think the exchange saves money, but absolutely the Affordable Care Law is going to cost more. I'm not arguing that point at all, and I appreciate your kind of defining over what we're talking about. That's an excellent point to make. And
I was just going to say that maybe somebody's got their phone on. They can turn it off. We're getting that little feedback. Representative Holman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, have you done a calculation if you look at the, what about the 3% of the state that's uninsured right now that doesn't qualify for, my understanding is about 9% of the state's uninsured currently. If you take out those that are eligible for programs, that actually it's about 3% that don't have access to something. Have you done any calculation on what the cost per individual is to implement all of this to get that last little bit of the population insured?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I've not done that calculation. What I've been told by the modeling or seen in the modeling is that about 300,000 more currently uninsured Minnesotans will find their insurance as a result of the market.
Mr. Chair, I think there's other people that have questions as well.
Yeah, there are a couple of others. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Atkins, for sharing the fact that the Affordable Care Act, even though its goal was to make health care more affordable, it clearly isn't, especially given the numbers that we saw from the Gruber-Gorman study and so forth. But my biggest concern is, and I mentioned this to you one time before, is that, Minnesota did something similar to this in the past with the health match and with the goal of trying to match citizens to plans and so forth. And we wound up spending $41 million and have nothing to show for it. And given the fact that you're assuming that on the low side, even, that there's going to be immediately a 40% participation in this, I just question whether we are truly operating off of good numbers and if we are going to be repeating the same mistake of health match and spending millions and millions of tax dollars with nothing to show for it in the end.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Anderson, I'm glad you pointed. The health match was a half-baked idea that was poorly implemented, poorly planned, I'm glad that we've, and when we get to the House floor, I anticipate talking about the significant differences between the two, so I'm glad you pointed it out.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins. I'm asking you, what is your backup plan?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the however many people decide to enroll in the exchanges, who is what happens? I think that the enrollment is going to define how large of a there's certain base staff funding that will be necessary just to operate it, but everything else after that is enrollment driven. And to the extent there's more folks involved, there will be more money coming through it to the folks, to the extent that there's fewer. In the meantime, though, we're just trying to put together a plan that works, and that's what the point of the A202 amendment was to hopefully have something that starts in a strong way and continues on from there.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins. I hope that before you come to the floor that you've got kind of a backup plan if the 40% participation rate doesn't come through, of what that backup plan will be, so that we're not basically repeating the health match and spending millions and millions of taxpayers' dollars. I just had one other question that's separate from this, and this is regarding, earlier you had mentioned that there's three plans that are out of the 11, three out of the 11 that are already not going to be participating in the health insurance market exchange, in the health insurance exchange. And I'm just wondering, because they're not participating in this, are we going to have a situation where people will not be able to access their current doctors that they're under and that they will have to change doctors? And what do you see as far as that goes? I'm assuming that's a yes, but if you can enlighten me as what citizens can expect, if they're still going to be able to access the same folks that they've been seeing for years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the answer is yes. They can still buy a plan that allows them to access the doctors that they want to access. Whether it's through the exchange or outside the exchange, that's a choice that the individual consumer has.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So, but Representative Atkins, if they're not part of the exchange, if they are not part of that group, obviously they wouldn't be able to access the same doctor, correct?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, if they choose not to buy through the exchange, they choose. I mean, we're not forcing anybody to buy through. If they still want to ensure that they're going to have a plan that they want and that has certain providers, they can do that.
Representative Huntley.
I'll pass.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins. Part of the reason that we're moving so rapidly through the committee process is the timelines that you've laid out for the members of the House. in complying with the federal requirements that are put down that we have. Can you tell me how many other states are either past, equal to, or ahead of Minnesota in terms of passing the legislation that we're going to be passing, I'm assuming, Monday?
Chairman, Representative Dean, I don't have the up-to-date figure, but I'll bet Ms. Momlov does, and while she's coming down, I would say we are definitely not rushing through the committee process. My wife and children can attest to that fact. After 61 hours of testimony and hundreds of amendments and 8 or 9 committee stops, plus what's going on in the Senate, this is definitely not a rushed process by any stretch of the imagination. But I think Ms. Momlov will have a more specific answer to your question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, there are 18 states besides Minnesota that are moving forward with a state-based exchange that have been approved by the federal government.
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Melma, they have already can you talk about the certification for this, for how Minnesota, let's say we pass this bill, it goes through our legislature and signed into law, what has to happen from the federal government to certify that? Are we immediately certified upon passage? And if so, does that certification take place through the administration or through CMS? And that is kind of what I'm asking. How many states have actually achieved that sign-off or that certification, if I'm getting the process correct, and I believe I do have it correct.
Ms. Mullen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, so us, in addition to those other 18 states, have been conditionally certified. And so there are numerous conditions that we will need to satisfy prior to October 1st to be fully certified. The legislation is one of those things by the end of March. There are also some dates that we will need to meet. Some of them are even specified in the bill language. For example, getting rules out around the Navigator in-person assister program by the end of April, that's one. There are also requirements around the IT system of certain benchmarks that we need to meet over the spring and summer. And so full certification of all the states likely won't happen until the end of the summer or early fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Melmoth, are you aware of any state who is further in development of their legislation and exchange than Minnesota is currently?
Ms. Malma.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, there are 10 states to date that have passed legislation that have also been conditionally certified, and there are another at least 4 that have executive orders for their exchange that have been conditionally certified. So in terms of legislation, there are 14, at least 14 other states that have already established that benchmark.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Malma. I'm not aware of the states and their relationship to the federal approval. I know that in October, when we were looking at meeting with a lot of the other states, that we seem to be further along with our development than almost any other state. And I'm wondering, and I have not seen a comparison of those states that I saw then in terms of how much money that we had invested into the program to date, and I haven't seen that in very limited research as this has moved through, but that's something I'm sure that we would probably want to know before we vote on the floor.
Ms. Momlo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we do have an accounting of all of the other states, how much grant funding they have received, and so we can definitely, that's available, we can provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins. It kind of reminds me of when I was on fishing on Lake of the Woods with my dad, and the storm came up, and you couldn't see anything, and we were just inundated in our little boat, and then it started to clear a little bit, and we were still very lost, but there was a line of boats behind us, including a bunch of big launches that were following us, and we were completely lost on the lake. And I just want to make sure that we're not in my 16-foot Forester here with huge launches of other states behind us. I want to know that that's not the truth. And just finally, Representative Atkins, Are you still thinking for Monday on the floor for this bill? Are you still on course for that? And if so, is the normal, are you anticipating that the normal deadlines for the amendment process be in line for that?
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Dean, I'm not in charge of that. I think it's coming up on Monday, and I think that allows folks to have several days to construct potential amendments between now and then.
The normal process will be followed, yes. Representative Woodward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, I wanted to follow up just a minute on Representative Anderson's question about a choice to choose outside of the exchange. And you'd said that, of course, you always have that choice not to buy your insurance within the exchange. But if you were to make that decision, am I correct in that you wouldn't get the tax credit, right, that is under the ACA? Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, that's exactly right. You know, you've got, there's certain trade-offs that you'd have you just have to decide what's more important to you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then,
Representative Woodard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, shifting gears just for a second here, I wasn't in civil law, so I had a question about the data that would be shared with other state agencies and the federal government. And I think the language under 14.28 says that you'd share it with other state or federal agencies only to the extent necessary to verify identity of, determine the eligibility of, process premiums for, investigate fraud, those things. Could you give me a few examples of what that information would be that would be shared with those agencies?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, at risk of misspeaking, I will do the best that I can. But I have, throughout the process, looked at people like Representative Holberg and Representative Simon, working with Mr. Turpin and people like Rich Neumeister and Don Gemberling, to try to craft language with our staff that protects people's privacy as best possible. What has been described to me is that to the extent that we gather data as people apply, that we then, for specific purposes only, have the ability to test that against what federal databases may show. So if they represent their income to be a certain amount, and I'm looking over my left, Representative Holberg, if I screw this up, but if we need to confirm just that their income is what they represent, that we can ping that and get that data. We don't share that necessarily with the federal government, though. It's just something that we have certain access to databases so that we can confirm what they've represented in their application form.
So Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as a follow-up to that, would that include things like citizenship, mental health issues, those kinds of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I don't believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't remember which exact committee it was, but you thought that the report would be out by the end of the week. Is that still the timeline that you have for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, was that the question about the Gruber? Okay, I apologize. And if I might, I do know that lawful presence is a factor, but citizenship, I just wanted to make sure that I completed the answer to Representative Woodard. My understanding is that, yes, we will have, and you pointed out earlier that some of the numbers may change or something like that. None of the numbers, none of the conclusions, none of that you've already seen will change, period. But there will be sort of the textual explanation of what this all means that we expect to have by the end of the week.
And Mr. Chair, as author of this bill, would you advocate? To your leadership that this bill not come to the House floor until that report is available to members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, what I would suggest that you do, I fully expect, based on all the representations that have been made, is that the textual backdrop for the one that we got in April? Will look very similar to what we're going to get in the next couple of days. So if you want to see what the text is going to look like, it's just the numbers that have been updated. So quite frankly, I'm perfectly comfortable with that, as long as I've got the final numbers, which I have. If I didn't have those final numbers, there's no way I'd want this bill to be heard yet. But I've got the final numbers, and I expect the textual explanation stuff is going to look like exactly what we got back in April. So that doesn't trouble me in the least. If it helps people understand the numbers better, then I'd suggest that they look at what we got in April, because that's a pretty good explanation of what drove those numbers and what was underlying the calculation.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm guessing that your answer to my question is no, that you're not going to advocate that report be ready before this goes to the floor, and that the April report is good enough for you, or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, the recent numbers are what I wanted, and I've got those. Those came in January. We've got up to date. We've got the final numbers. I think, and maybe it's just a matter of what people are expecting this text to show, but it's not going to be much different than the text that we had back in April that underlied the numbers that we had in April. All it's going to do is sort of update the text, but the numbers aren't going to change one bit.
And Mr. Chair, if that's the case, why are we at the end of the February without the text? If the text is no big deal and the numbers have been ready since January, why are we at the end of February with no text?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, we've impressed upon Dr. Gruber that we want, I think it's because there's lots of text. And we wanted to get the numbers sooner. Maybe we should. You know, arguably, if we had to do it over again, we maybe would not have shared anything or asked them to give us up-to-date numbers. But we thought that would actually help the process and would enlighten people a little bit to have those new numbers, knowing full well that it might take a little while longer to get the underlying text done.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, are you willing to provide the contract, a copy of the contract that was entered into, in order to receive this report so we can review the contract?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I don't actually have the contract. To the extent that I can provide it, it's my understanding it's been out there or around, but I don't have it in my file. But I'll talk with the exchange staff about providing it.
I see one of your phone friends behind you sitting, shaking his head.
I just channeled some information that apparently it's a copy is actually on the website right now. But that's not good enough, though. We'll make sure that I'll send you a copy.
Mr. Chair, I can find the website if, in fact, it's up there. And I guess I'm just going to share with you, I think it would be only fair that that report be available before this bill comes to the floor.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I'd like to see it, too. I think folks' expectations for it are way beyond what will actually be revealed in it. I've seen what the April underlying text looked like, and you know it's the numbers that are what's guiding us here. So I understand the request,
Mr. Chair and Representative Adkins. The taxpayers of the state of Minnesota paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for this report. This is a big policy issue with major ramifications. To a large part of our economy, a large portion of the taxpayers that are going to be forced into using this in order to get a tax credit or if they're on a public health program. I mean, it would be nice to see the governing document before the bill passes the House floor.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I hate to belabor it, but it's not our governing document. The legislation that we pass will be our governing document, just for the sake of the record.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I'm going to just try this one more time. What is your backup plan if we're looking at not meeting our goal of 200,000 new enrollees? Because that's what it's going to take for us in order for this to fly and to actually achieve the savings that you've been talking about. If we don't get the 200,000 enrollees, we don't get any of the savings, what is your backup plan at that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, whether it enrolls 200,000 or 20,000, our only backup plan, if it fails and we stop doing it, would be that there will be a federal exchange imposed upon Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
And Representative Atkins, and when I say savings, meaning a difference between the Minnesota exchange plan versus the federal exchange plan, so then the default is that we would just go to the federal exchange then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, if we stop operating it, then we will default to the federal exchange.
Great, thank you.
Any further discussion?
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think I have the answer to your question. It's on page 8 of the fiscal note, subdivision 6, in the last sentence. It says, assume that the marketplace will establish certification requirements that the risk of negative enrollment as impact is mitigated. That and basically says that there is going to be competition. It's going to be within the exchange versus outside the exchange. And what Section 6, Subdivision 5 says is that that's going to be manipulated in order to perpetuate the exchange. So I think that that's the answer to your question.
Mr. Chair, that's a load of crap. That's not what it says at all, Representative Dean. But if that's what you choose to think that it says, what Representative Anderson asked is what's the backup plan? And what the answer is simple. If we stop operating, then we default to the federal exchange. And you can interpret that and you can say what Section 6 says. And the fact is if and when we stop operating it, and by all the models, that's not anticipated. We expect upwards of about 1.3 million Minnesotans will get their coverage through this plan. But I appreciate the question, Representative Anderson. The bottom line is if we stop operating it, we end up with a federal exchange that costs even more.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, you may not like my interpretation of that. And I tried to ask you this before. I got a similar answer. But I think what Representative Anderson is asking, what others have asked and trying to get at, is that competition and that balance between what's in the marketplace, what's outside of the marketplace. I know that you're wary of that. I know that you worry about it. I hope you worry about it continuing going forward, but I don't think that that it deserves that type of response from you.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I apologize. What you just said was not a load of crap. I agree. I absolutely do worry what's going to happen inside versus outside. Mm-hmm. That was part of the reason for the A202 amendment.
Okay, any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert.
If I might. Back to the report, and I'm sorry to fixate on this,
fine.
But I'm just, and I will go look for the April report as a preview of what's coming later this week. When they did these models of the low, medium, and high enrollment numbers in order to back in how much tax revenue you have to raise to support all this infrastructure and bureaucracy, et cetera, did they, similar to like when Global Insights does economic forecasting, they do probabilities, 60% on the baseline, 20% pessimistic, 20% optimistic. In this report, was there any factoring or prediction as far as the accuracy of the numbers and the likelihood of whether you're going to hit the low, medium, or high enrollment and what the factors are for that?
Representative Holbert, I don't have that at my fingertips, but I believe that it was reflected in two ways. One, in the way that you described it, they also then gave us the high, medium, and low enrollment models to talk about the prospects. And they also, I believe that the numbers that they are projecting, they also are 2016 numbers. So they're a couple years out from, we don't expect on January 1st, 2014, to immediately enroll 1.3 million people, but over the course of time, we expect that figure to go up. That is reflected in the report, but I apologize for not knowing all of that off the top of my head.
Mr. Chair, I know you've had plenty of time to reflect on your wonderful bill sitting for your 60-plus hours in committee, and I know you've been fully engaged for every minute of that testimony and discussion as you've made your way through your 8 committees or whatever. So you're the expert. What do you view the probability of hitting even the medium enrollment projections?
And thank you. And Representative Holbert, there's also another, the Wakely consulting group that also did some enrollment modeling for some projections. What I think, and I'm going to couch this a little bit because I want to see what comes out of the final committee. If we go to a conference committee, if the Senate doesn't just take what we plan to do,
I think with the amendment, the likelihood of having a significant enrollment goes up because we'll have greater participation. We'll have a guarantee of the popular plans that are being sold in the marketplace. So that gives me a great deal more comfort and will mitigate against the probability of adverse selection issues that could, you know, end up in this spiral downwards. And so I think the medium to high enrollment, particularly when you add in the potential of getting tax credits, is a very reasonable figure to expect, particularly if we're reasonable in how long we expect that to take. And I think that's why the models have been based on 2016 figures, is because it is going to take a little while for people to warm up to it and decide that this is something that they're comfortable buying their health insurance through.
And Mr. Chair, at what point, how long would you recommend that the legislature go if we're not meeting these figures, you know, in 2015, 2016? You know, when should we get nervous? When do you think the newness and when will we know whether this works or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I'm nervous right now. I don't have a crystal ball. I just know that we've only got two choices here. One is to do something of our own creation, and the other is to default to a federal exchange. And I'm just not willing to put at risk what Minnesota has spent 150 years building to let the feds do it for us. But I would start to answer your question, though, because that's a very genuine answer. But I would hope that within the first year of enrollment, sometime by the end of 2014, that we'll have a pretty good sense of whether or not this is going to succeed or not, and whether people are coming to the website and finding that it's a user-friendly opportunity to buy their health insurance.
And if I might, one more maybe Karnak or crystal ball kind of question here in reading some of the latest committee reports and information coming out of Washington, D.C., there seems to be growing concern on whether or not the feds are even going to be ready on October 1st to flip the switch on this whole thing. Do you have any feel for that, whether or not their systems? There was some discussion in a committee within the last week that the antiquated computer systems at IRS, et cetera, how are they ever going to interface with this exchange program? Do you have any feel for that component?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, just an awareness of the same concerns. That's part of what troubles me about letting the federal folks do an exchange for us or to us, is that I don't think they're going to be prepared to do it as well as we can. And we're well on our way to doing it well.
Mr. Chair, we're going to have to interact with their systems, is my understanding. They have to approve everything that we do. So if we're so far out ahead, I mean, it's not, they have a lot of control over what we do here, and I guess I'm just a little concerned some of the initial rumblings coming out of Washington, D.C., which of course it's not the main story of the week coming out of Washington, D.C., but I'm concerned that they may not be ready to flip the switch on October 1st.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Holbrook. I'm concerned about all those things.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
And I know, I'm sorry, I know some of our members were in other rooms. We've tried to send people to go get them. I don't know if higher ed's done yet, but we've sent some of our staff to go get some of our members.
When did you send them?
Probably about 3 or 4 minutes ago.
We'll try to be accommodating.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I think higher ed is done. Is there somebody else that was on that committee that confirm whether or not that's the case?
We had a couple people who were up there. They're not here either. I don't know the answer to the question.
Yeah,
Could you go through the bill again?
Yeah.
I think we know the.
Bring pizza this time.
I think the outcome is probably pretty clear. So.
No, Mr. Chair, I think we can just vote.
Okay. Rep. Atkins, if you would renew your motion.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 5 has been to be recommended pass and referred to the General Register.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Meeting adjourned.